The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Chatter. I'm Shane Harris. This week, historian Benjamin Breen on Margaret Mead, psychedelics, and the CIA.
An internal CIA history about the origins of the agency very early on says Mr. Bateson wrote a memo to General Donovan proposing the creation of an intelligence agency that would be specializing basically in psychological warfare, and which he says would be more important than the traditional military in the atomic era. They had a real point when they saw this as a battle between good and evil science. You know, like, I know that sounds so naive now in the aftermath of the Cold War and the 20th century to see it in those terms, but it was a pretty stark moral choice. Do you want to use your credentials, your expertise to defeat Hitler or not? Mead's whole scientific mission is in some part a response to World War I, a belief that science needs to prevent future trauma and future conflict of the sort that she witnessed as a teenager and young adult.
Benjamin Breen, welcome to Chatter. Thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me, Shane. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you. So I have, I must admit, when I first saw the title of your new book, I did a little bit of a double take. The title is Tripping on Utopia, Margaret Mead, the Cold War, and the Troubled Birth of Psychedelic Science. And the Cold War in psychedelic science, or the Cold War in psychedelics, that's not what caught me up, because as an intelligence reporter, I'm familiar with the various dark chapters of the CIA and psychedelic research, which we'll talk a lot about in the conversation. It was the Margaret Mead part that made me go, wait, what? My mother was an anthropology major, so I grew up hearing Margaret Mead's name, you know, mentioned in the context of someone who was like an equivalent of Einstein in her fame as a scientist. I think our listeners will probably know who she was. But just give us a quick reminder of Margaret Mead and who she was and where she was sort of in the American landscape. But then how it was that she became interested in psychedelics and mind-altering substances.
Yeah, I also did a double take when I started researching this book. So I understand that feeling. It wasn't initially my aim to draw these connections or to really even center the book on Margaret Mead. I wanted to write a history of psychedelic science during World War II and the Cold War. And it started to gravitate around her. And I think a good way to explain who she was is just to explain why it gravitated around her. A lot of things gravitated around Margaret Mead. She was a force of nature. She was one of those people who moves through history and truly influences the world, not just because of her intellect, although she was quite brilliant, but also just through her personality. She was extremely willful, extremely principled and inspiring as a person. And that made a lot of enemies. You know, a lot of people I talked to didn't like her very much on a personal level, but a lot of people I talked to hugely admired her and saw her as like a heroic figure. So she was polarizing, but also really impactful and just a really fascinating historical figure. And in terms of who she was, she was a cultural anthropologist. So that meant a different thing when she began her scientific career in the 20s than it does now. It was much more of an expansive field. Her father was an economics professor at the Wharton School, and she actually had a lot of social science background that was more broad-based than what we might think of today with an anthropologist. She was very interested in psychology, for instance. And really, the reason why she became the central focus of my book and became central to the history of science in the 20th century is because she was probably, I would say, the leading proponent of what in the book I call applied science, the idea that science can be applied to solve major problems in the world. And in fact, after World War II, and even before World War II, in response to World War I, Margaret Mead starts to see her own role in history and the role of science as entangled with this larger project of preventing another global conflict, preventing another world war. Maybe a trite way of saying it is saving the world, but there really was that kind of heroic quality to the way she saw science and herself as a scientist. And that's really why she plays such an impactful role in the book, because the book is largely about the utopian yearnings and striving of the first generation of scientists who develop psychedelic therapy, and also the ways that the Cold War puts a lot of utopian goals of science into conflict with the practical realities. And her life, so basically, just became a perfect test case for that story. And also, she became an amazing figure because she was, well, two things, really. She was an amazing writer. So her own notes and her own memoirs are beautifully written and give this great insight into the psychology of the people at the time. But also, she knew everyone. I mean, she knew absolutely everyone. It was just crazy. Mm-hmm. The people I spoke to who had known her, the names that they mentioned calling her on the phone was like Lyndon B. Johnson would talk to her on the phone, according to one person I talked to. Pick your famous scientists. She knew them. Oppenheimer, mm-hmm. You know, she knew all those people. She knew Einstein. And so being able to center her in the story let me just tap into all this amazing other sidelines of psychedelic science and the Cold War.
When you talk about psychedelic therapy around this time, what ways were psychedelics being used in a therapeutic setting, which, of course, is an idea and a practice that is seeing something, I guess, even of a renaissance now. But as you write, I mean, this is really practice that goes back to the 1920s and 30s. So how were people using the substances back then?
Well, one important thing, and not to get too into the weeds, but the word psychedelic is not coined until 1957. So I'm actually doing a little bit of a, I'm a professional historian, and historians tend to call that an anachronism, like we're pushing back a term. And I do that, I think, with good reasons, because otherwise I would just have to say psilocybin, LSD, mescaline, and just give the actual drugs every time I say science involving these things.
Yep. Exactly.
So I just say psychedelic science. But even before the term itself was coined, there's a broad-based interest in using drugs as a tool, really, for surfacing repressed memories, healing trauma, and generally just kind of excavating the unconscious mind. It's sort of the second or third wave of Freudian therapists, but also others. You know, Mead was not really a Freudian, but she was deeply interested in trance states, altered states of consciousness more generally, and the unconscious mind. And so there's this perception among scientists in the 20s and 30s that there can be uses of both hypnosis and drugs, you know, like not just psychedelics, but also drugs used as sedatives to basically heal trauma. And that really is kind of the basic starting point of psychedelic therapy today. And there's currently a huge amount of interest in the scientific community in doing just that in the 2020s. In the 20s and 30s, it was very much a response to World War I. And some of the earliest patients who used mescaline in a therapeutic context were actually World War I veterans. Mm. And so that's really the starting point for that story. And again, Mead's whole scientific mission is in some part a response to World War I, you know, a belief that science needs to prevent future trauma and future conflict of the sort that she witnessed as a teenager and young adult.
So is it the kind of, it's almost like a treatment for what we would now call PTSD, sort of seems to be kind of one of the starting points.
It absolutely is. In fact, like histories of PTSD actually begin by talking about narcosynthesis, which in the book I argue is like the prologue to psychedelic therapy. It's basically the use of sodium amytal, which we can get to later because that's a truth drug that was used by the CIA and other intelligence agencies, I think. And so it's usually known as a truth drug, but it was actually pioneered as a therapeutic tool during World War II. And it was a practice called narcosynthesis that was actually quite influential, widely used in the military in the 1940s, and then kind of forgotten about and overshadowed by psychedelic therapy. Yeah. But really, it's the same people and it's the same basic idea.
How do they broadly in the military in these circles stumble onto this? I mean, Mead had done research with the Omaha people, right? I mean, had seen their use of peyote. So are those kind of some of the first introductions they're seeing to chemicals that create these altered states?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting story. I didn't have space in the book to dig into that like 1930s intersection of anthropologists studying indigenous uses of psychedelics. I talk about Margaret Mead's study of peyote in 1930. There's many others. I mean, a lot of her colleagues and friends were also studying peyote at that time. It was a pretty common interest of cultural anthropologists. At the same time, there's the emergence of like basically therapeutic forms of hypnosis. And Margaret Mead is very interested in that as well. So early on in World War II, she actually visits the Menninger Clinic. I don't know if your listeners have heard of William Menninger and his brother as well. The Menninger brothers were these very influential figures in sort of like their early, basically the early medical establishment in the 1940s and 50s. But in World War II, they were highly looped into discourse around mental health treatments in the military. And she visits the Menninger Clinic and gives a lecture on Balinese trance states, which then is listened to and inspiring to these psychedelic, I mean, these narcosynthesis researchers who, and several of them later do work with psychedelics. And so there's this intersection of the anthropological study of peyote and trance. And then also, on the other hand, the early military psychiatry world where they're trying to think about how to apply these tools in the context of, you know, preventing soldiers from succumbing to PTSD. And also just the beginnings of like, you know, the mental health care in the United States on a mass scale. Because in the 50s, that's the high point of institutionalization of mentally ill people. And so it's really the convergence of these three different stories. And Margaret Mead, again, is just sort of like the Forrest Gump of the history of science. She's just always there. She knows everyone. So even though I actually want to say she was not like, she didn't make psychedelic therapy a central focus of her life at all. She was focused on all kinds of other stuff. She had like 10 different focuses that were more important. The thing is, she was just so hugely energetic and so impactful in terms of the connections she made that almost by accident, she laid a foundation both intellectually and also sociologically by connecting these people for what became psychedelic therapy. And then also, we could talk about this, I think we'll probably move on to this. She was really looped in with the, you know, the State Department, the OSS in World War II, and a lot of the key figures in the sort of covert side of psychological warfare were friends of Margaret Mead's and in some cases close collaborators with her.
Yeah, we'll get to some of those. Let's introduce another character in the story that is really pivotal, both to your story but also to Margaret Mead's life, and that's Gregory Bateson, which is a name that probably many people may not be as familiar with, certainly not as famous as Margaret Mead. But give us a little a sense of who he was and their relationship.
So Gregory Bateson was also an anthropologist, but he was British, and he came at it in a different way. So his father, William Bateson, is a really important figure in the history of science as well. He was the first to use the term genetics, and he was like really a key player in the history of genetics after Darwin. And so Bateson grew up in this very sort of distinguished scientific family. Both of his brothers died young. And so again, it's that influence of World War I and the trauma of the 20th century shaping the mission of these two people. I centered the book on Mead and Bateson's relationship in part. I also move away from it, and it kind of interweaves with the larger history of psychedelic science. But I liked looking at their relationship, both romantically, you know, they're married, but even more intellectually, because they let me talk about the ways that the history of warfare and the history of trauma in the 20th century intersected with these really utopian goals. And so one way to look at that is through Bateson's family background. Like his oldest brother dies in a pointless infantry charge at the very end of World War I. Like I say pointless because the war had already been decided. This is like the final months of the war. They had no business trying to do this, but it was just one of those senseless moments of which there are countless in World War I. And his brother dies, I think, at the age of 20. And then 4 years later, his other brother commits suicide on the anniversary of the first brother's death in the middle of London. So this is a deeply traumatized family and a family that has like really suffered. And Bateson is left to carry on the legacy of the father and try to be a great scientist. So he had a lot of emotional resonance for me as a person. And I found him a deeply sympathetic figure. He was also a figure who was really self-doubting in a way that contrasted strongly with Mead, who was incredibly both self-promoting and also self-confident, you know, just like polar opposites in that way. And so Bateson also has his own really fascinating story in psychedelic therapy and psychedelic science. Like in the 50s, he becomes a key mentor to some of the founders of psychedelic therapy. And he also, as we can get to, was in the OSS in World War II. So he was actually one of those key points of connection for Margaret Mead getting kind of interwoven with the, I don't know what we want to call it, the national security establishment, or something like that.
Right. In World War II. Deep state. The early deep state.
And so he's a fascinating outsider figure because he's British. And initially he tries to join the British war effort in World War II and actually joins this really fascinating project that was about observing the ambient psychological mood of British people during the beginnings of World War II, like the effects of Winston Churchill's speeches psychologically.
Yeah.
And he
this
kind
is
of
the famous journaling project.
Yeah,
right,
journaling project. Wanted to include more on it because I thought it was so cool. But he found it very unfulfilling and boring, apparently, from what I can tell. And so he then in World War II gets actually quite involved, more than I expected. He ended up not just having a desk-bound office job, but actually went overseas in Burma and elsewhere. And so that was a whole way into understanding not just the Cold War aspect of the story, but the World War II aspect of how psychedelic science is sort of forged in this furnace, this cauldron of horrifying events, you know, this like really intense period that it emerges out of.
And that's a good pivot we can talk to about the OSS. And I think as context, something I didn't appreciate until I read your book was the degree to which scientists like Mead and like Bateson saw work with the government or an intelligence agency, in the case of the OSS, or in the war effort, as a patriotic duty, right? And that they were fighting a good fight. I mean, I came at this sort of with the thinking of a 21st century person that, you know, thinks about people of that kind of cut being maybe more skeptical about government. Mm-hmm. And this is a different time when we're talking about here where scientists are really pitching in. So talk about the OSS then and the work that they end up, that they start doing. As a way of entering into this, what was the OSS interested in when it came to these kinds of drugs, not just psychedelics, but other mind-altering substances? Why were they curious about that?
Yeah, just to start off, the OSS is the Office of Strategic Services. So a lot of your listeners probably know this, but just to clarify, and this is I was surprised researching this. I always assumed that there was some kind of federal intelligence agency predating World War II, but not really.
Yeah.
There's naval intelligence and there's military, but this is the first predecessor to the CIA. And it's founded, as far as I can tell, almost directly at the urgings of Winston Churchill. The high up British leadership is pushing FDR early in World War II to establish some kind of federal governing body for intelligence gathering that would sort of match MI5 and MI6. And it's really a kind of shoestring operation at first. It starts off with a very small staff, and it grows quickly, but one of the fascinating things about it is how amateurish it was. And I don't really say that in a judgmental way. It just had to be. And so it was hiring people who we now think of as spies, right? Like Alan Dulles. But at the time, Alan Dulles was working at a white shoe law firm on Wall Street, I believe, right? It was the lawyer, Alan Dulles. You know, a lot of them were journalists as well. And quite a lot of them were scientists, like a surprising amount. So there's like, I would say based on what I've seen, the main recruitment pool for the early OSS was journalists and scientists. And it sort of makes sense when you think about what they're trying to do. You're trying to find people with language abilities, right? People who have field research experience, like experience going to another country.
Right.
People with connections on the ground and people who are good at writing and analysis. So it's a lot of them are academics. Quite a lot were anthropologists, actually. And so it makes sense that Bateson got looped into that world quickly. As far as like the moral and ethical standpoint, I've noticed some people's reaction to the book sees those chapters of the book about the OSS as almost condemning the people who participated. But I don't see it that way. I think that they saw what they were doing in very stark moral terms that are defensible, actually. You know, like I read several biographies of Hitler while researching this book, and I read quite a lot about Nazi Germany and the intelligence services of the Nazis and also the role of science in general in World War II. And they had a real point when they saw this as a battle between good and evil science. You know, like I know that sounds so naive now in the aftermath of the Cold War and the 20th century to see it in those terms, but it was a pretty stark moral choice that was, you know, presented to them. Do you want to use your your credentials, your expertise, your knowledge to defeat Hitler or not. And you know, they made that choice, and I don't judge them at all for choosing to do that. It is true that some of the things that OSS ended up doing, especially in light of this, what the CIA did carrying that forward, look pretty bad now. You know, like, so for instance, now to move on to what the OSS was doing in the drug world, I should say they weren't really that interested in psychedelics per se in World War II. They were interested in trance-inducing substances, let's put it that way. It's actually this is actually a new book that's coming out called Tripped that gets into the Nazi mescaline research. Maybe you could talk to him, Norman Ohler, the guy who wrote Blitzed.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He's a German researcher. He actually got dug into the Nazi mescaline archives. When I say mescaline archives, what I mean is that there was actually a pretty strong research program of using mescaline as an interrogation tool in Nazi Germany, yeah, as I understand it. But I didn't really cover that in my book. I was looking at what the OSS was doing in response to that work, because the OSS and the British intelligence services were vaguely aware of this through picking up signals, you know, signals intelligence that told them there's something happening with drug research. And also just purely because, you know, the Germans were the leading drug manufacturers in the world in the 30s. So they knew that they were up to something involving drugs. That was very clear. One branch of that is that the British and later the United States military start pushing for more amphetamines to be given to soldiers because they're aware that the Nazis are doing that. But then the other branch is this truth drug research. And so the OSS gets involved pretty early in this. There's research into hypnosis as an interrogation and generally just like a tool to be used in intelligence. And then alongside that, there's what's called the Truth Drug Committee. This is from a document that's actually held at Stanford that's totally fascinating because you can see that it's a part of an iceberg of other documents that probably don't exist anymore or are not accessible. Yeah. It was left over in George Hunter White's papers. He was a narcotics cop who some of your listeners may already know of because he was like one of the central figures in MKUltra. He was like the sort of corrupt cop who was a CIA consultant who did a lot of the most ethically questionable dosing of civilians in the 50s. And in fact, he was doing very much the same work in 1942, 43, it turns out. I looked through his diaries at Stanford and looked through this document on the Truth Drug Committee. And he was enlisted by the OSS to basically be the sort of the tip of the spear for their most out there truth drug research. And by out there, I mean out in the world. They wanted an actual testing of truth drugs efficacy on unwitting people. So
like a truth serum, like a drug I could give you in an interrogation and you confess everything.
Yes. They wanted to see if that worked. And it was like, you know, the stakes were very high, right? Again, this is 1943. There's no certainty that the world war is going to end with the Allies winning, right? It's still in doubt. And there by 43, there's a lot of POWs that have like extremely impactful information. Just one example would be the Manhattan Project is underway at this point. The Americans are aware that the Germans have an atomic weapons program as well. That could be something that could be found out. You know, that's like information that could literally change the course of the war if you find that out. And so the interrogation work is like a very high priority, it would appear, for the OSS. So the director of research for the OSS is a guy named Stanley Lovell, and he writes about it in a sort of weird way in his memoirs because the only thing he really mentions is like a very goofy sort of outlandish plan that he has to basically hypnotize or dose with drugs a German POW and send them back to Germany to assassinate Hitler, which is like sort of the origin of that Manchurian candidate concept.
Manchurian candidate, yeah.
I think that might be the first like mention of it. And I don't think there was any real work done in that world. And I think that's actually why Stanley Lovell mentions it in his public memoirs, right? Because this is, you know, he's just like playing around.
Because it's not too secret.
Because it's not a real thing. He doesn't really mention the actual program. And this is mostly just been pieced together by journalists and historians in the 70s and 80s after the, you know, congressional revelations of the CIA's subsequent work in this field. But yeah, George Hunter White in his diaries is basically giving cigarettes that are laced with THC to random people he picks up off the street. He has a fake name. He calls himself Morgan Hall. He says he's in the Merchant Marines. He gets people drunk. He hangs out with them. And then he gives them what at the time is a totally unknown drug. THC is very familiar now because it's the main chemical constituent in cannabis that is mind-altering. But at the time, it had just been discovered. And so he's like all scared of it. It's like this unknown compound. Mm-hmm. And he's giving it to people and then recording what they talk about and just trying to figure out if it works.
Was there ever, I mean, did they ever stop and say to themselves, hey, this is actually a fairly unethical and maybe even not scientific way of experimenting and testing with these drugs? Or was the idea more that it's war, we're involved in a secret pursuit through the OSS, and therefore we need to be, you know, covert about how we go about this?
I think that it doesn't really come across in his diary that he was concerned about ethics at all. And really, again, it's 1943. Yeah. I mean, so I'm not excusing him. George Hunter White is one of the most unsavory people I've ever researched. He was not a good guy, almost by his own admission. Like he later writes a letter to Sidney Gottlieb, who was like his CIA handler, where he basically says, it was great that I had a chance to, I think he uses the terms lie, rape, steal, and murder with the sanction of the All Highest or something like that. So that's like kind of a mission of guilt couched in strange nostalgic tone.
For sure.
And so he was like definitely on the far end of the ethical scale that I look at in the book. It doesn't come up at all in his diaries that he's concerned about it. But one interesting thing is that he's not a fringe character, even though he's not a direct OSS or later a CIA employee. He's more of a consultant. He's working mm-hmm. directly with people your listeners have heard of. So during the time when he's doing his, what he calls in his diary, his TD research, truth drug research, he has like a meeting at a hotel where he gives the truth drug THC, which is not a truth drug, but he thinks it is. At the
no.
to like a, it appears to be like a volunteer group of US soldiers. And then he meets with James Jesus Angleton. Maybe you can tell people who don't know who that is.
Sort of a legendary CIA officer and possibly one of the most deeply paranoid people ever to have served in senior ranks of the CIA, which is sort of the contemporary, well, post-war idea that the CIA has been surrounded by spies and people from within the ranks. I mean, Angleton is kind of like that. He is essentially the Matt Damon character, I think, in The Good Shepherd. Mm-hmm. But yeah, a legendary CIA officer and not necessarily for great reasons either.
Yeah, legendarily paranoid. And it's kind of fascinating to think, did he smoke THC cigarettes in that hotel room?
Does that make him paranoid?
The implication in the diary is that he's giving these things to some of the important figures involved in counterintelligence to kind of mm-hmm. inoculate them against the use of truth drugs on them, right? That's what's interesting is that it's not just like an experiment. It's also like a training program for a lot of the key people in the OSS. And he also gives a little speech to the trainees at one of the OSS training camps. And Bateson appears to have been one of the people in that group because the dates line up, where he basically fills them in on narcosynthesis and the use of drugs in interrogation. Not because this is like, he's not spilling the beans of his like very specific work, but there's an emerging sense that if you get captured by the Axis powers, you might be given some unknown drug and we need to prepare you for that. And that becomes a really important factor in the Cold War later on.
Yeah. And would you say, I mean, is the upshot of the OSS's research, I mean, it's not so much right that they invent a truth serum or anything like that. Is it more that they kind of are looking at this from a defensive perspective? I mean, if you had to sort of say, you know, what is the sort of creative output of all of this research?
My honest answer is I don't think I have access to enough documentation to say what they were trying to do. I know that they were trying to see it in both defensive and offensive terms because Sidney Gottlieb, who is later the kind of key figure in the CIA version of this work in the 50s, he actually is initially told to go through the old OSS files and figure out what the OSS was up to. And he describes the work that grew out of that as having both a defensive and offensive side. So on the one hand, it's used to prepare potential intelligence operatives to be dosed if they're like, you know, the attaché in Moscow and then they wake up out of a trance in a hotel room or something. But on the other hand, it's very much being thought of as something that could be used like literally as a weapon in a military context, but then also in interrogation or actually there seems to have been real thoughts about, for instance, giving Fidel Castro LSD without his knowledge right before he gives a speech to embarrass him. This is something that the book Poisoner in Chief by Stephen Kinzer gets into a fair amount of detail. So yeah, it was on both angles. But in terms of the emphasis and especially in terms of what the actual usable information that emerged out of that was, I don't know. Some of it was probably destroyed in the 70s, right?
Yeah,
So it's, who knows? That's the fun thing about this work is that a lot of it is still somewhat mysterious. And I kind of enjoyed that feeling that I was just seeing little bits and pieces of a larger story.
Right. There's an element of things being shrouded in secrecy, which is kind of appropriate for an intelligence story.
And also the whole Soviet side. I mean, that just in passing, from what I can tell, there probably was a Soviet side to this research. Like they had counterparts of Sidney Gottlieb and George Hunter White in the USSR. But as far as I know, it's not really well known at all what was going on behind the Iron Curtain when it comes to this sort of covert drug research.
And so much of it seems to me to be really so prescient in a way, because, you know, the United States is, of course, you know, they're looking at Hitler and the Nazis and this idea of, you know, mass propaganda. And as they start out probably too, like, you know, almost mass delusion. I mean, the things that Hitler was inspiring in his followers. You know, you mentioned hypnosis. I mean, people are thinking about the power of suggestion of the mind, you know, and today we think in terms of psychological warfare or information operations as being this asymmetric capability that nations can wield against one another. So it strikes me that they're kind of the people who you're writing about in this early World War II period are really pioneering into an area that is going to become a legitimate, real rich subject of warfare and intelligence, you know, in the decades to come.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if your listeners are wondering how do Margaret Mead and Gregory Bateson fit in to George Hunter White, that's the answer is that they are really important figures in the formation of this group of people called the Committee for National Morale, which has a sort of vague name, but it basically was an early group of civilian scientists, even before World War II formally begins for the United States, even before Pearl Harbor. There's like this emerging awareness that scientists need to kind of pitch in with specifically psychological insights into the nature of the enemy. And a lot of this was things that, you know, for instance, Ruth Benedict's The Chrysanthemum and the Sword is a famous book about, like, quote unquote, Japanese psychology. It's quite outmoded today and makes a lot of assumptions that are overly simplistic, but it was thought of as like a very useful tool for understanding Japanese, you know, planning and decision making. A lot of the same work was being done in regards to, like, quote unquote, Hitler's psychology, you know, and this gets into a lot of like weird territory where people are psychoanalyzing Hitler. And it's not really considered great science today, but the people involved in the Committee for National Morale were like very influential. A lot of them ended up becoming some of the leading scientists of the 20th century, not just Mead and Bateson, who were core members, but Henry Murray, who became a very influential psychologist at Harvard. And this is the connection to George Hunter White, James Alexander Hamilton, who is not well known at all, but he's a Berkeley and then later a Stanford psychiatrist who was close friends with Margaret Mead and then later was a colleague and friend of Bateson in the OSS, working under Henry Murray in the OSS Assessment School, which was like the psychological, basically a kind of gauntlet of tests you had to go through to enter the OSS. So Hamilton is not well known, but he's kind of an influential figure at the time. And he was actually the psychiatric consultant for George Hunter White's truth drug experiments. And the fascinating thing is that it was not just a partnership that happened in the OSS in World War II. Later, and we can get to this in the 50s, when George Hunter White is enlisted by the CIA to do the same type of research with LSD, he brings back in James Alexander Hamilton. So they're like a duo who are like, you know, one is like the scientist who can write papers about it and kind of give a kind of reasoned explanation of what's happening. And then the other is the, you know, fist fighting narcotics cop who carries a gun on his belt and like stabs people with knives. He's like very proud of stabbing people with knives at various points. And so there's like this real sort of sinister buddy comedy aspect to these two that I think kind of symbolizes what ends up happening with the partnership of scientists and the OSS, right? There's like the top level of these very highbrow intellectual and really idealistically motivated and, you know, ethical people. Like the Committee for National Morale was something I support, right? They were trying to defeat Hitler by contributing their scientific expertise. Great.
Right.
But then that in later parts of World War II in particular, it merges with that sort of the gray area epitomized by George Hunter White, where the ends justify the means, and it gets into some pretty weird territory. But yeah, the psychological warfare thing, I think you can make a strong case that the Committee for National Morale really was the progenitor of psychological warfare as we know it. They kind of created the field. And in fact, Bateson, and I didn't know this until halfway through researching the book, the CIA website has a lot of fascinating material that has been released through FOIA requests over the years. And one thing I found on there was an internal CIA history written by Arthur Darling about the origins of the agency that on very early on says, Mr. Bateson wrote a memo to General Donovan proposing the creation of an intelligence agency that would be specializing basically in psychological warfare, and which he says would be more important than the traditional military in the atomic era. And so it turns out Bateson is like quite significant in by the CIA's own telling in that the emergence of this concept. And his whole group was called Morale Operations. So again, they're not calling it psychological warfare, but that idea of national morale. What you actually, when you look at what Morale Operations was doing, it very much was psychological warfare. That's what they did.
That was one of my favorite things in the book too, is finding that that Gregory Bateson, former husband to Margaret Mead, influential researcher in crossing over into psychedelics, kind of helps come up with the idea of the CIA, and is arguably one of he's providing sort of an intellectual impetus for the need for an intelligence agency that specializes in these kinds of things.
Yeah. I mean, one of the interesting things about him, as I said, is he's so he's a very self-aware figure, and he has a lot of thoughtfulness about his own life. And so he ends up kind of disliking the CIA quite strongly, right? And he has like a lot of, I think, mixed feelings or even strong misgivings about that role. And it was surprising to me too to see that. I should say it's hard to know what the thought process was, but we know that General Donovan actually did see the memo and it moved through the infrastructure of the OSS, because that same internal history says that there was like a follow-up letter from another OSS officer supporting Bateson's case. Mm-hmm. And so it does seem like that actually was important in the decision-making. Yeah.
Talk a little bit about Bateson in the OSS too. I mean, he was recruited in, right? He's an anthropologist. He becomes friends with some other notable people who served in the OSS, but give us a little flavor of his time working with them.
So a lot of what we know about his cohort in the OSS comes actually, surprisingly enough, from research into Julia Child. So I don't know if this is widely known among your listeners. I kind of had vaguely heard this as like a fun fact before I started researaching this book, but Julia Child was in the OSS.
Yeah, that's a known thing.
It's a known thing. Yeah, there's a book called The Covert Affair that really helped me with getting into the really fun details of the training. Because Julia Child was in the same group that trained with Bateson. There was like this group of people who all ended up writing memoirs or becoming famous like Julia Child and eliciting this attention from subsequent journalists. And so I was able to piece together his experience in training and early on in the field with a really striking level of detail, because Julia Child was there with him and people are just interested by that. They were the two tallest people on their transport ship across the Pacific. It's a fun little detail. So
that's great.
They started hanging out because like they were both unusually tall. I think they were
Two tall people.
Yeah, Bateson's like 6'4". She was 6'2" or something. They were friends. And so that was really interesting, just seeing through the lens of people like Julia Child and then also a couple other people who are not as famous but who wrote memoirs later on, what they went through early on in their training. It was very, very strongly psychological. So it wasn't really, there was a little bit of weapons training and traditional spy craft. There was one thing that came up that I read that was like, I don't know if Julia Child and Bateson did this, but I thought this was interesting that one of the OSS training, I think maybe the final training maneuver that they did would be to drop someone in an urban environment. In the case I read about Baltimore, and asked them to break into a factory and steal documents. And then if they got caught, they were on their own. Like they couldn't explain that they were being trained to be a spy. It was just
That's
like,
amazing.
You're left to your own devices, which is actually quite dangerous, you know, if you think about it. And so there was that kind of thing, like the true cloak and dagger aspect. But a lot of it was just testing how people acted under pressure. And this was where James Alexander Hamilton, Bateson's and Meade's friend, was really important. It was things like they would do an activity where the trainee was asked to collaborate with two or three other people building a structure, but unbeknownst to them, those two or three other people were actually pretending to be fellow trainees. In reality, their job was to completely screw up any process that they underwent, you know, to make it impossible to actually build it. They would constantly drop things or not understand directions. And it was basically just to test how well they performed when they were super mad or frustrated, that kind of thing. Another thing that came up in one of the memoirs that I thought was interesting that Bateson actually participated in, because again, he was older and he was friends with some of the people doing the psychological testing. So it seems that even when he was being trained, he was actually also hanging out with the observers in the OSS. One of the memoirs says that at the end of their training, they had a big party. And Bateson and Hamilton and some of the other psychological assessment people came into the room with a bunch of alcohol, whiskey and champagne. And they had not been drinking during the training, so everyone got drunk. And one person revealed their true identity, because all through the OSS training, you're not supposed to say who you are. You get kicked out if you mention who you are. This person thought, okay, well, it's over now. I can say who I am. They got kicked out. That was the final test, was how they act when they're drunk.
Isn't that great? That's great. There's another sort of mind control.
I couldn't include that in the book because I didn't have enough space, but I loved all that early OSS training material. So there's a brief period after he completes training where Bateson seems to be involved in studying hypnosis for the OSS. And that's something that I talk about in the book, but it's very unclear from the documentation exactly what was going on there. There's just a few documents that show him involved in a hypnotist who is talking to a volunteer, a Japanese-American volunteer, and the goal seems to be to use hypnosis to understand Japanese psychology. So it's part of that kind you know, understand the enemy sort of project. After that, he ships off with Julia Child across the Pacific, and they go to Ceylon, modern-day Sri Lanka. Yeah. And that's where the Morale Operations Unit kind of forms, the psychological warfare unit in the China-India-Burma theater in World War II. Mm-hmm. And after that, he actually goes to Burma, works behind enemy lines in Japanese-occupied Burma, trying to basically find ways to induce rebellions among the local population and to decrease the morale of Japanese soldiers. So there's like a lot there I didn't have time to describe in the book of sort of fun, or in some cases sort of disturbing intelligence operations in Burma. He crosses paths there with George Hunter White, who is actually in India at the time, and they actually celebrate the defeat of Hitler, Victory in Europe Day. George Hunter White, Bateson, and James Hamilton stay up late drinking alongside Jane Foster, who ends up being a Soviet spy. So I love the little like clue of the Cold War beginning just as World War II is ending in their lives there.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And this really is, I mean, and you get such a feel for this in the book, and people can tell now listening to you tell these stories. This is a small clique of people who are involved in this research, who knew each other. I mean, maybe not some of them, maybe not like necessarily, George Hunter White, because I mean, he's kind of his own shady person. But these circles are fairly, you know, tight, and the research that they're interested in is kind of bringing them together. Did they talk about this outside, that you can tell, of the work that they were doing with the government? Or did they regard this as something that was, you know, needed to be very closely held and kept under wraps?
This is where the Cold War aspect really interested me, because, and this is true with a lot of people who, you know, have family who were in World War II, right? A lot of people came back from World War II and just never talked about it. My grandfather was in World War II. I never spoke a word to him about it. And I Same. Think that's a very common experience of 20th century life, not just in the US, but in any country affected by the war, right? There was a kind of silencing of people's experience. And in some cases, there was a regret that set in. Bateson was deeply regretful of his role in the OSS. And I think to some extent, his scientific career afterward is almost atoning for it, or at the very least responding to it. You know, he wrote a lot about the science of manipulation, because he had participated in that and saw it from the inside and wanted to sort of counteract what he was seeing during the Korean War in particular later on. And so what happens really is a splitting between the people who become lifers after World War II. You know, like, they're just like in it, and they're not going to, they're going to have a civilian life, but they're going to stay in the intelligence world, the covert world, pretty much for the rest of their lives. And then the people who see it as like an episode that they'd rather forget. And so I think that's really where that pairing of Meade and Bateson interested me the most. Bateson wants to forget all about World War II. He doesn't want anything to do with it. He stays friends with James Alexander Hamilton, but doesn't seem to be approving, from what I can tell, reading between the lines of their correspondence, doesn't seem to approve of Hamilton's continued role in the CIA. Whereas Margaret Meade, this is probably the most surprising thing I found out while researching her. She had a CIA officer living in her basement for long stretches of time throughout the late 40s and 50s. He was her close family friend. And in fact, he actually was, I think, and this is, again, I'm on somewhat shaky ground here because it's very hard to ascertain anything about like a 1950s CIA employee if they don't want to release the documentation. But it would appear that he was using a Meade research project sponsored by Margaret Meade as a cover story when he was an operative in Burma, in fact. This is a guy named James Meesberg, who had been close collaborators and colleagues with Bateson in World War II. And that's kind of like what I mean about the people who become lifers and the people who don't. Bateson right. just moves on after World War II, whereas James Meesberg and James Hamilton, pretty much as soon as it's possible to them, join the CIA. In like, I can't tell exactly when, but it would appear to be like 1949 to 1951, very early on in that
history. Yeah, very early.
And, you know, Meade is still interwoven with their lives, presumably talking to them about what's really happening. In their inner letters with Meesberg, it's really interesting because he, you know, his cover story in the 60s is that he's like a, it's a very thin cover story. He's like a PR rep for an otherwise unknown airline based in Saigon.
Right. Like, it doesn't sound shady at all. That sounds like a real job.
And then his other jobs are like Burma and then Indonesia in the mid 50s. And it's like, okay, I can kind of see what's going on here. But when she talks to him in these letters, she never acknowledges what his job is. But when they talk about things, it's very clear that she knows, you know, like he talks about having rockets fired at him during the Tet Offensive.
Right, right. And being on his belly in a helmet trench. And
yeah,
kind of
so it's like, okay. And likewise, he's talking about like the psychology of communist intellectuals in Burma in the late 40s with her. And it's like, that's very strongly of interest to the early CIA, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20.
And that's what's so interesting too about is you know, it's I feel like some people might approach the question of, you know, the agency's interest in psychedelic research as something that's purely, you know, a chapter of like MK Ultra, which we'll get into here in a second. But what your book is really making this persuasive case for is of course, an agency that is trying to figure out what people are thinking, how leaders are going to operate in a time when people are becoming more and more fascinated by psychology and the mind. It seems only natural in retrospect that the OSS and the CIA would be putting a lot of energy into some of these subjects and that they were going to run into people like Mead and Bateson.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I wanted to do with this book is to situate psychedelic therapy and psychedelic science in this larger context. Because it's usually spoken of in isolation as a sort of niche topic.
Yes.
Like if you don't care about psychedelics, it's, you don't care about the stories involved typically.
Yeah, it's like some weird like appendix to history as opposed it's like to like some, a pillar in it.
Some weird stuff happened at Harvard in the 60s, the dolphins on LSD, like weird little stories like that. But actually it's and you can make a case that it's central, but even if you don't want to argue that it's central to the project of the Cold War, it's like an important element in a larger story. It's exactly as you say, this story of interweaving science into this epic struggle between two blocks of the world. These two inheritors of the world after World War II are seeing science as central to what they're trying to do. You know, it's very much an offshoot of Oppenheimer's story, right? There's the atomic physics version, and then there's the psychologist anthropologist version, and they knew each other. As you say, it's a small world. This is like the people who are involved here are socially involved as well. And just like Oppenheimer and the early Manhattan Project physicists are facing this question of what's going to happen after World War II. You know, we've contributed our scientific knowledge to defeat Hitler, basically. But now what? like, how is this changing the world? A very similar thing is happening with anthropologists, psychologists, and psychiatrists, where they have contributed their knowledge to write psychological profiles of Hitler, contributed it to understand hypnosis, both as a healing tool and also as a weapon, and truth drugs, among other things. But now what? And Margaret Mead is willing to kind of see what happens for a period of time in the early 50s in particular. She's trying to actually assert real political power. She's trying to get involved in the State Department. If you look at her FBI file, which is quite long and interesting, there's a lot of stamps on it showing that it was consulted by not just the CIA, but the State Department, the Office of Naval Intelligence, the NSA, all through the 50s and 60s. So she's like, she's getting interwoven into that Cold War story. And it's not just a story of truth drugs. In fact, that's just a tiny part of it. It's really a story of using psychology and understanding of consciousness and the understanding of people's lives as a tool of the Cold War, as a way of winning the Cold War. It's what Ellen Dulles calls brain warfare. And so, of course, yeah, I agree. It makes complete sense that scientists who study the brain or human cultures would be important in that.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about one of these darker chapters we've alluded to, which is MK Ultra. And for people who know anything about CIA history or even sort of vaguely, they will remember that one standing out as one of the, you know, even if you only knew the shorthand, you'd say, right, that was when the CIA was secretly, you know, dosing people with drugs. Talk about the origins of that program. You know, why did the CIA get into this research? What was it doing? And then along the way, you know, weave in some of these characters that we've been talking about who obviously figure in that chapter as well.
Yeah, this is I teach at UC Santa Cruz, and my students all know a ton about MKUltra now. It's so interesting. And I ask them why, and they're like YouTube and TikTok. It's just like, yeah, it's become part of the cultural ether. It's just floating around.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's, you know, I kind of avoided it while researching this book because I didn't want to go down this rabbit hole of, like, you know, reading all these books about it. It's a whole thing. It's kind of like a little industry unto itself. And a lot of what's written about it, frankly, is filled with misinformation or just misunderstandings of the history. It does show up in my book. But one of the key things I want to emphasize, especially for this audience of people who know a lot about this topic, many people listening to this may know quite a bit, is that it's kind of a misnomer to say MKUltra to mean this whole set of concerns and interests involving the mind, the brain, and drugs in the 40s and 50s. When you look at people like Sidney Gottlieb, who really is an important figure in MKUltra, he doesn't see himself as a pioneer. It appears that he sees himself as just continuing forward the work of the OSS, right? And so I actually think it makes more sense to think of it as MKUltra as like one chapter in a larger story that goes back at least to the 1940s and continues, I guess, probably up to the present. It can't really be documented, but the use of drugs and the science of consciousness in intelligence and the military is a bigger story than just this one set of projects. Part of why MKUltra has taken on this cultural resonance is because there was a very highly publicized series of congressional hearings, yep, centering on it. And so, you know, Ted Kennedy grilling someone about whether they gave LSD to unwitting civilians in San Francisco who had been like seduced by sex workers. That's like great for creating a New York Times headline in 1975 or whatever. And so that's a huge part of why that particular subset of the story has gotten so famous or infamous. There's also the Manchurian Candidate. That whole concept became like an obsession of mid-20th century culture. And it kind of gets interwoven with this project. But yeah, I mean, MKUltra was, given all that hedging, it was an important CIA project in the 50s and early 60s. It did involve quite a large infrastructure of affiliated researchers running into the hundreds of people, if not thousands, who are directly being given funding. But most of them, the vast majority, are unwitting recipients of funding. So in that sense, it's very similar to like the famous CIA project of funding like abstract artists or funding the Paris Review literary journal, you know, which did happen. The vast majority of the people involved in those projects, as with MKUltra, were not aware that they were getting CIA funding. But the people who were aware are key figures in my book. So, for instance, Harold Abramson, who hasn't come up yet, was a member of the Committee for National Morale. He had known Margaret Mead and Bateson since that time in the early 1940s. He became a chemical weapons researcher during World War II. And he was one of those people who became a lifer after World War II, even though he continued to work as a pretty like boring seeming job. He was a specialist in childhood asthma. And he was basically just involved in like, you know, treating asthmatic children in 1940s New York. His sort of night job, as it were, was to consult for Edgewood Arsenal. And it's starting right around 1949 and running on into the 70s, it would appear. He is consulting directly for the CIA and for chemical weapons researchers in the military, and getting quite a lot of funding, actually, from those channels as well. Mm. And so he becomes one of the key figures in this intersection of witting MKUltra researchers, meaning people who are like fully aware and have security clearance. You know, they're directly participating with CIA employees. Abramson ends up becoming, I think you can make a case, the most influential LSD researcher in the United States, maybe the world, in the mid-1950s. And he is friends with Margaret Mead and Gregory Bateson at this time. So by looking at their archive, I was actually able to find new information about this very secret program, which many of your listeners may know, a lot of the files were destroyed. MKUltra, what we know of it is actually pieced together from really boring, basically the kind of documents that I fill out in my job as a professor when I travel. You know, it's like, I needed my per diem for going to the city. I need to buy recording equipment. I need to make photocopies. It's basically, we're piecing it together now from the stuff that was considered unimportant enough to not destroy.
Yeah, the pocket letter.
Yeah. Yeah, just like the reimbursement request and stuff like that. So we knew Abramson was involved, but by looking at his story through the archives of people who were friends with him, we suddenly could see this different angle on MKUltra, a more human angle, if you will, and actually understand what they were trying to do. Abramson was fervently anti-communist. So he wasn't like this evil mad scientist who was just doing this work because he thought it was fun. He saw it as like a continuation of that World War II ethical imperative to that the ends justify the means. Mm-hmm. The means. And what was that work? Well, he was meeting with George Hunter White and giving him LSD, it would appear, based on White's diary. Abramson was also doing sort of like the more like scientific side of MKUltra research, where he was publishing papers on the effects of LSD that were not behind any kind of security. They were fully public and they were just part of the scientific world. But at the same time, he was also sharing the results from that work with people like Sidney Gottlieb, who were then applying it as a tool or as a way of understanding both potential Soviet research in the field and also like ways of actually, you know, instrumentalizing these substances in actual intelligence work. And one thing that made him of interest to the CIA, I think, was he was a specialist in the gaseous diffusion of chemicals, right? That was his actual background. He invented, in fact, aerosolized penicillin, which was a very important treatment at the time for people with like bronchitis and pneumonia. But aerosolized LSD was another interest of his, right?
Yeah, you can imagine the mind reels with the possibilities.
It does indeed. Yeah. And this was probably one of the strangest chapters of MKUltra was not the sort of sordid stuff about like unwitting people who are basically dosed with LSD and subjected to this like psychological kind of nightmarish scenario. That's what people talk about the most. But I actually found most disturbing the little hints and pieces about testing and experiments involving like releasing LSD into a subway system, like, you know, or into like spraying it over a city. Like that was actually things that were investigated and thought about as a potential real scenario in the 50s. And it's kind of, the mind reels thinking about that, you know, like releasing LSD in a water supply of Moscow or New York City, for instance.
We think about LSD now. I mean, well, I think people think a few different things about it. I mean, some people will associate it with a kind of 1960s counterculture and, you know, young people, hippies tripping on acid, whatever. And some people will have a more maybe contemporary understanding of it as like a therapeutic, you know, the kind of things that have been done with psilocybin research with cancer patients, that kind of thing. What did people like, you know, the Angletons and the Dulleses and the sort of the intelligence chiefs of the world in the 1950s and 60s, what was their understanding of what psychedelics did? I mean, did they see them as consciousness enhancing? Did they see them as substances that just put people out of their minds or made them susceptible to manipulation?
It's hard to say. And I wish I could know whether Ellen Dulles did LSD. I can't rule it out.
Right.
It's actually kind of seems possible to me, maybe even plausible, because we do know that the mid-level people used LSD. And I'm not going to get into all the names. It's a bunch of people you've never heard of, but the kind of people who were like reporting directly to Ellen Dulles, you know, the sort of Sidney Gottlieb's bosses and the people who are one layer above him. We know from Gottlieb's testimony and from MKUltra documents that they were given LSD as it's just sort of like, here's a thing that we're investigating, try it out. Almost like as if it was just like another little gadget, you know, like, because there were lots of
things. Here, like kids, take this home and tell us what happens.
Yeah, let's see what happens. And you know, for instance, the Frank Olson case, which I talk about in the book, the chemical weapons researcher who jumps or is pushed out of a window to his death, that was the occasion for his use of LSD. You know, it was like a retreat for chemical weapons researchers where they were just all dosed, because that was just sort of the thing you did in 1954, 1953. You know, it was just like, here, try this. Let's see what happens. It's good to try and just see your reaction to it. So a lot of them had firsthand knowledge. You know, Sidney Gottlieb definitely used LSD, like I think over 100 times, certainly dozens of times.
Wow.
So he was kind of an enthusiast, it seems, right? There's another guy named James Ketchum, who did, I don't know if you read that New Yorker article about him by Rafi Khachaturian a few years ago.
Oh, I don't think so.
It's really good. It's a really good New Yorker investigative piece, I think called Operation Delirium, that was based on James Ketchum's diaries. James Ketchum was on the military side of psychedelic research. Ketchum ended up becoming a huge proponent of LSD. He enjoyed it personally. He used it, you know, as a sort of tool for insight. But he was also testing it as a chemical weapon, right? So a lot of them were in this kind of uneasy middle ground where they sort of saw both sides, I think. On the other hand, there's others who were just sort of didn't want to go there. So George Hunter White corresponds with the drug researcher in the 70s as he's dying of alcoholism, actually, where he says something like, I've tried some of these substances. And then he even hints like something like working for a three-letter agency, which I cannot name. And then he says, I felt like I had some kind of psychological insight from them, but then it vanished as if in a dream, you know? So he doesn't want to go there. He's just like, yeah, it was kind of fun, but it's sort of interesting, but it just didn't really add up to much. And I think a lot of them, the people on the covert side of psychedelic testing, probably had that attitude where it's like, that was weird. And then they moved on with their lives.
Right.
Sidney Gottlieb, however, is fascinating because he ends up, and this is covered in Poisoner in Chief, he kind of becomes a hippie, right? He starts like an organic farm. He gets involved in Eastern mysticism and spirituality. So there is something going on there. I wouldn't be surprised if he's one among many in the CIA who had a path like that. It's basically the origin of the Man Who Stared at Goats people. You know, the sort of
It's interesting. I hadn't made that connection until you pointed that out. But there is a kind of you can imagine how a pathway sort of opens, you know, kind of leaning more towards mysticism and that kind of internal journey that you know, could lead people down a road like that. So where is the point at which the CIA basically stops looking into all of this? Because, I mean, obviously there's not a, you know, operationalized use of psychedelics in the CIA, at least not that I mean, not in the modern era, not post the Church Committee and the investigations of the 70s that exposed it. But what is it that basically makes Langley say, yeah, we'll move on to something else here?
I mean, I think partly it is the Men Who Stare at Goats factor, that there is still an interest in what we could call paranormal research or kind of like esoteric science in the CIA through the 80s and I think the 90s. But it gets channeled into different avenues once LSD becomes illegal. You know, the fact remains that this is no matter how weird and out there the CIA got in the 50s, they're still buttoned up government employees. They're taking drug tests. They're going through physicals. You know, they're not going to knowingly just like publicly violate federal law in an above board program, at least, shall we say, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. They leave that for the really secret stuff.
Yeah. And so I think that it was almost like just on a social level, it was a different thing when in the 50s, it's like, oh, my Columbia trained, you know, Harold Emerson was a medical doctor who had a Columbia degree and was very well educated and was actually a really strong proponent of LSD as a therapeutic tool. So when he's saying to a CIA officer, hey, you should try LSD, here's my studies about it, it's very different from like, oh, LSD that my teenage son is using in his high school, you know. And in fact, actually, interestingly, James Meesberg, who doesn't really seem to be involved in the drug side at all, he was more of just like a, I don't really know what he was, honestly. I know he was in the CIA because I had it confirmed by two different people.
This is the guy who lived in Mead's basement.
The guy who lived in Mead's basement. Yeah, I got confirmation from two different sources that he was a CIA officer, and everything checks out with that backstory when you look at his biography. I think he was not at all involved in that story. But when I read his letters, he was writing to Cora Dubois, who was actually another OSS anthropologist. She was in the OSS and became a Harvard anthropology professor. They were friends from that period in World War II. And he writes to her that he's visiting his friend who is a CIA officer. This is one of the ways I confirmed that he was in the CIA, because he's staying with this guy at his house in Washington, D.C. And he's like, he's a shared friend because this guy had been in the OSS, but it's like now like 1972 or something. And he said something like, his son has become a long hair. He's having trouble with drugs. I'm going to talk him through it. So it's like a cultural shift, right? Suddenly it's not a thing that you do in your urbane dinner parties with your Princeton or Columbia friends.
Yes.
It's a thing that like the riffraff do at rock clubs or something.
Exactly.
And so I think a lot of it really is just that cultural or social shift with the sort of role played by psychedelics. I think also, frankly, I mean, my own take is that it doesn't seem to have worked very well. I don't see much evidence that they got anywhere, right? These things are not truth drugs. It bears repeating that THC, LSD, psilocybin are not truth drugs. They don't work that way.
Yeah.
And so if you investigate them for years and years, eventually I think you reach that conclusion. On the other hand, the use of drugs has not gone away as far as I know. I mean, I'm getting this mostly from like... just my own reading of like Ben McIntyre, you know, that guy who writes the Traitor and the, what is it? The Spy and the Traitor? Is that what it's called?
The Traitor and the Spy, I think it was.
Traitor and the Spy. Yeah. I liked that book. And I noticed that there was like a little truth drug sequence in that book. And this is a Soviet dissident who doesn't really have any reason to lie about that detail.
This is the whole sodium pentothal idea, right? You know, you inject somebody with it and then they give up their secrets.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that was still being used by the Soviets in the 80s, apparently, based on that account. And so that part, who knows? I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there's still ongoing work with drugs. I just don't think it's like, you know, an intelligence officer tripping on LSD, thinking about life, and then writing up a report about it. That probably isn't going on anymore.
The reports might be a little verbose if they did, and a little impenetrable and ineffable. You know, and you talk about in the book, and we don't have time to go into it now, but you do talk about the way in which, you know, the counterculture, of course, you know, is picks up LSD, and it is, you know, sort of, as you alluded to, it's like the kids doing it at concerts, and, you know, Timothy Leary is probably the biggest cultural figure associated with that kind of part of the movement, and people like Richard Alpert, who becomes Ram Dass. And, you know, you write very persuasively that, you know, that's not actually the beginning of the psychedelic movement. They're kind of the ones who ended it, really. Leary especially, who I think your book and others have portrayed in this way, is kind of a narcissist and really a marketer. I mean, somebody who tries to almost claim that he's the one discovering all of these mind-altering substances when really he and his circle of people from Harvard are kind of glomming on to earlier research and just, you know, mainstreaming it to some degree. But there's this really fascinating moment near the end of the book that features Leary and then Richard Alpert. And Albert Hofmann is giving a speech at UC Santa Cruz, where, of course, you work. And Hofmann, for those who don't know, is the scientist who essentially discovers the chemical LSD, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, famously, accidentally, when he's working with Urgut, I think, discovers it and accidentally ingests it and gets high, and he discovers LSD. Leary is in the audience, I guess, and talks about the LSD movement that was started by the CIA. And so here's Timothy Leary in the end with the father of LSD and Leary asserting that the CIA started the LSD movement. And I guess my question is, you know, is he right? You know, you kind of position this scene as near the climax of the book. So to talk about that, this assertion that Leary is making and that line that he is drawing between the agency and the movement that he is associated with.
Yeah, good question. No, he's not right. I think quite strongly that he's wrong. I think that that's actually part of his self-aggrandizing and self-promoting mindset, is he'll seize on anything. Timothy Leary really liked being in the news and getting headlines. So when the Church report comes out and when there's these congressional hearings in the mid to late 70s revealing MKUltra, of course, Timothy Leary gloms onto that and is like, oh, wow, it was all a big operation and I was the center of it. You know, that's sort of more an expression of his own ego. He had no connection to the CIA side of the story, aside from the fact that he was trained by a lot of these OSS psychiatrists. So that is true that he was aware of, probably was aware of some of the OSS truth drug and hypnosis stuff, because they were like, you know, his advisors at Berkeley and so forth. But that's true of that, pretty much that whole generation of psychologists, actually, because those guys ended up becoming like, you know, the leading scientists of their generation, right? Henry Murray and so forth. So no, I don't think he's right. I think there is very much a strong covert component to psychedelic research, not just the CIA, but also crucially the military is very important in that story. Military usually gets left out, but that's like at least half of it, right? And certainly in terms of funding, it's an important role. And in terms of like the sort of overlay of paranoia, definitely. There's like a perception increasingly among researchers, including Bateson, who, as I said, was personally friends with a lot of the people who were on the covert side, even though he disapproved of them, they start to become aware of something shady going on behind the curtain, right? So I think that's an important factor. But they didn't start it. No, it predated the CIA. I mean, this is one of the main things that as an historian I'm trying to bring to the table here is like sweeping away the misinformation. The CIA was founded after LSD was first being used in therapy, right? So it's you can't make that claim. Did the CIA popularize LSD and other psychedelics? Yes, that's true, for sure. I mean, and there's an unclear element here where, for instance, Gordon Wasson is like this banker in New York who's actually friends with Alan Dulles. Probably, I think it is in fact confirmed that there's some CIA link there. Like, I think there was a CIA employee who went with Wasson in his journey to the Mexican highlands in search of psilocybin mushrooms. So there are stories like that.
Wasson being the guy who basically popularizes mushrooms.
Yes. In America. And then he publishes it in Life magazine, which is published by Henry Luce. And actually, fun fact, Henry Luce, this is not something I saw in any biography of him, but early on when they're trying to find someone to be the earliest employee of the OSS, like the director, one of the first names thrown out is Henry Luce. Again, they're looking for journalists. So he's like Margaret Mead, people like Henry Luce are very interwoven with that world and are aware of this stuff. So yes, there's definitely like an entanglement, shall we say, with the military and the CIA throughout the whole history of psychedelic therapy. But you can't make a causal argument. It has many origins. And one of the key things I wanted to do here is kind of rehabilitate that side of the story, because it served people like Timothy Leary to say, hey, we're the good guys. Everyone before us, they were the men in the gray flannel suits, the squares, the establishment, spooks, you know, this whole kind of set of cliches of baby boomers about like the generation that preceded them. Whereas they were very complex people that preceded Timothy Leary, right? And by the way, Leary was not a baby boomer. He was from that older generation, but he wanted to cater to the new generation. That's what's weird about him. He acted much younger than he was. But the people involved early on included some figures who I think were borderline, could be labeled sociopaths, like George Hunter White. But it also included people who I actually admire and hold in high esteem, like Margaret Mead and Gregory Bateson, who did not willingly go into the dark side of psychedelic therapy or the whole science of the mind, but tried to kind of put it on a more positive course. They were practically and you know, they were aware of and pragmatically aware of what was happening, but they were not succumbing to this like darkness of the Cold War. They were trying to intervene. And so for Timothy Leary and people like that to just paint it all as like, oh, it was a CIA operation is obviously simplistic, but I also think it's an injustice to the actual motives of the people involved.
Yeah, and we're now, I mean, in 2024, you know, we're in this period of, you know, renewal in psychedelic research and psychedelic therapeutics. I mean, we've been talking about these dark chapters, we're arguably in a very chapter of light now, where you have, I mean, the FDA poised to authorized psilocybin for treatment of PTSD. You know, the medicalization path of psychedelics is following a lot of what happened with cannabis before that. You know, cancer patients talking about being completely alleviated of their anxiety about death after one treatment with a psychedelic. And the medicalization path has been one, I think, that's kind of made it more acceptable to people on a mass level, and people who are using it, not necessarily in a medical capacity either, but who are using it much more in the spirit that I think Bateson and Mead thought about in the 20s, 30s of, you know, consciousness expansion. Mm-hmm. So how do you chart, like, the moment that we're in now of this renewal in psychedelic research and use to the beginning of where your story starts? I mean, is this one of those patterns that you write about that Mead and Bateson created that are still with us?
Yeah, I mean, this is where I think I just want to say people should read the book, because I wrote the book with a really strong goal of directly commenting on what's happening now. And yeah, partly that was just because it came across so strongly that the lessons learned by this sort of forgotten generation of psychedelic researchers are really valuable now. You know, one of them being, stay away from cult leader personality types, right? The person, yes, the people who want to make it about them, to draw themselves as the sort of guru figure. History has shown the dangers of that when it comes to any kind of mass movement of applied science, right? But especially one involving strongly mind-altering substances. I personally am quite pro psychedelics. I think they have a lot of potential as medical medical uses, and also in again, like, the non-medical context of consciousness expansion. But writing this book and researching it made me pretty skeptical of the more utopian claims that are made, you know, like this concept, mm-hmm, of net zero trauma, that like psychedelics being legalized would like dissolve the world's trauma, obviously is false. I think if you look at the life histories of these researchers, there's plenty of trauma.
Yeah, after the drugs aren't quite that powerful.
No. Yeah. Leary's life was pretty harrowing, actually. And so I think that just like there are so many lessons to be learned from this older history that it's almost shocking to me that they haven't been told in this public way yet. And I think part of that is that a lot of them are buried in the archive, like they haven't surfaced in published accounts. Mm. Part of it is also just that the psychedelic renaissance, as it's called, is so new. So this book couldn't have been written in the 90s or the 2000s because I wrote it with the awareness that there's a growing group of people around the world who are using psychedelics in therapy, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. It's numbering it's not small. And that wasn't the case 10 or 15 years ago. And 10 years from now, it'll be much larger, I think. So yes, I think not just psychedelic researchers, but patients or anyone with an interest in the topic should read the book with all humility. I think it really would help people make sense of the history of what they're taking, because it is not something that either exists only in this indigenous past, you know, this like ancient hazy wisdom of the ancients sort of way that ayahuasca in particular is framed, mm-hmm, or mm-hmm, as like a baby boomer drug from the 60s. There's a whole other series of chapters that I've tried to tell that actually has the most use and the most bearing on the present.
Yeah. And we should say that where we've been sort of veering on one storyline through your book is on that covert side. But there's a whole other piece of this story that your book is about, too, that's exactly what you're describing. And they are interwoven, but they're distinct from one another as well. And I think that you make the pretty persuasive case that, you know, in the end, you know, the Mead/Bateson view of this is winning out over, you know, the damage that Timothy Leary did, arguably, in the 60s and into the 70s. As a final question, I mean, do you think of, like, you know, is there a sequel to this book that now is kind of like, you talk, we're in the middle of a renaissance, but it, what are the potential uses that you see beyond medicalization that somebody like a Bateson or a Mead would have looked at that and said, okay, maybe they wanted the utopia version, but are there things that you see beyond medicalization that they would have pointed to and said, yes, that's kind of what we were thinking about, these substances might be good for?
I mean, it's hard to answer. So one thing that stuck in my mind is actually a friend of Bateson and Mead's, Jeffrey Gorer, who's not a central figure in the book, but he's actually one of the people who inspires them to be interested in the science of consciousness. Jeffrey Gorer had taken mescaline as a volunteer test subject in the 30s in London, And then he meets Mead and Bateson and convinces them to go to Bali, where they start studying trance states and actually schizophrenia as well. And he says something like, mescaline, which is a substance similar to psilocybin and LSD, it's a psychedelic, is basically like a universal key for understanding altered states of consciousness. Like it helps you, he claimed that it helped him understand altered states of consciousness that were not based on drugs, but were based on meditation or trance. And he claimed that it helped him find some kind of commonality as he traveled the world. He was a big world traveler. He went to West Africa, all throughout Southeast Asia. And that kind of stuck with me. Like, I don't personally have a strong utopian case to make for psychedelics. I mostly just think they're useful, like, you know, for some people as tools of personal insight. And they certainly seem useful as treatments for PTSD. I don't think they're necessarily going to solve world peace or anything like that. But I do kind of think about that question of, we live in a very fragmented society, and it seems to be getting more and more fragmented by the day. I'm not the only person to be saying this. But if there is really something that's like a skeleton key for the mind that lets you tap into a shared sense of altered state of consciousness, some kind of shared, like if the brain really does kind of work the same way for everyone when we take these things, it's kind of interesting to me. Like it's creating a common ground, right?
Yeah.
That said, I have to square that against the history of psychedelics in the 20th century, which did not create a common ground. It created Richard Nixon's war on drugs, right?
Yeah.
So that's part of the conflict that inspired me to write this book, is my own internal ambivalence about what the takeaway is, right? And I leave that to readers. I've noticed readers have had, readers who see this as a strongly pro-psychedelic book and strongly anti-psychedelics, which is sort of...
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah,
I'm glad that that's been the result, actually, because I think you can... Depending on your point of view, you can see it both ways.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt it was definitely pro with caveats, I guess is what I would say.
That's what I thought too while writing it. But I was surprised. And we'll see. The time will tell. I think in about 10 years we'll know, because I expect 10 years from now, several psychedelics will probably be legalized. And one fun fact to end on. I don't know if people know the Sackler family. Like, they were written about in the book Empire of Pain. They're founders of Purdue Pharma, the opioid manufacturer. Arthur Sackler, the sort of patriarch of the family, shows up briefly in my book. He's there at the very first conference in North America in which LSD is discussed in a scientific context. It's 1950. And he's like asking, what are the effects of LSD? What does it feel like? And it's fascinating to me because, like, you can imagine an alternate reality where LSD gets rolled out as a blockbuster miracle drug medication of the 50s, right?
Yep, totally.
And it's like, I wonder if that might still happen. Like if we rethink these drugs as replacements for antidepressants or something, that will actually change the world. And I'm not sure in what way. It will probably make a lot of money for a pharmaceutical company if that happens. I don't know if
they can figure out how to make you keep taking it. Yeah.
I think that's ultimately why it didn't go that route, is it's not addictive at all. Whereas Valium is, and opioids certainly are. So for me, the big question mark right now is the commercialization aspect. And I think that will be a major news story of the rest of this decade, actually, because MDMA is probably going to be approved by the FDA, I think, by the end of this year, it's looking like. And once that happens, I think the floodgates will open and there'll be a lot more on the horizon.
I agree with that. Well, our tradition on Chatter is the very last question. I reach into this Chatter box and I ask you a question that has been pre-written, and I'm going to select it at random. And that is the last question that we always ask our guests. So your Chatter question is... Oh, this is great for an author. What are the books or book on your nightstand or on your list of books coming up? So what are you reading? You've just finished writing a book, so what are you reading?
Yeah, I'm actually reading a really good book right now by the writer Deborah Bloom. It is on my nightstand, but I actually have it with me because I'm reading it in my office too. It's called Ghost Hunters, William James and the Search for Scientific Proof of Life After Death. Yeah, it's sort of like the prologue to my book, actually, because it's about... William James was a really important scientist in developing the sort of foundations of the science of the mind, right? The idea of altered states of consciousness. He's like a foundational figure. He founded Harvard's psychology program, which plays a role in my book. And he was really interested, it turns out, in spiritual mediums and the supernatural side of science in the 1880s, and kind of became obsessed with it. So it's sort of like Victorian Ghostbusters sort of story, and it's really interesting to me.
That's great. That's great. That sounds. I may have to read that next. That's fascinating. Well, Benjamin Breen, the book is Tripping on Utopia, Margaret Mead, The Cold War, and the Troubled Birth of Psychedelic Science. Yes, everybody, go buy it. It's great. We've kind of like hit on the surface of some things and gotten some of the stories, but it's such a rich narrative and really compulsive reading. It's a great story. It's beautifully told. I really enjoyed it. And I'm really grateful for you to come on the show and talk about it.
Thank you, Shane. It was so fun to talk to you. I appreciate it.
You too.
That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter at That Was Chatter.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.